Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I'll tell you what, I haven't seen that many Democrats gather together in white suits since Ralph Northam's 1984 Eastern Virginia University Med School graduation party. Thank you very much. That was some gathering. Very interesting. It was not a speech, President Trump's State of the Union, that you're going to enjoy if you're a proponent of envy, infanticide, open borders, or Maduronomics. But if you're generally center-right in nature and reasonable in disposition, President Trump had a lot to say in his choosing greatness foray that I think people would receive well. And it turns out, based on the early exit polls,
they did. What are you seeing? Was it choosing greatness?
CBS had it 3-1. People received his remarks positively, and nearly 3-1, they received his remarks on immigration positively. Hmm. Not surprising. I mean, you hear, a well-crafted speech. I understand some of the criticisms about it, being technically stitched together and coherent thematically throughout. But I got to tell you, the attention span of most people, you have to create a sort of a wow factor or an interest factor with each component part of an hour and 20-minute speech. It has to be, 3 minutes of interest at a time, and they don't necessarily have to be connected because, frankly, people don't make some of those connections. They want a good story, and there were a lot of good stories embedded in what Trump had to say.
Yeah, there were calls for unity and, all of that and gobbledygook. But I know that it's since Ronald Reagan, people invite guests to attend the State of the Union. But I thought there were too many guests last night. I mean, it was sweet. Everybody sang happy birthday to the Holocaust survivor and the synagogue survivor. That was sweet. But it just kept going on. Right. And he is a hero, and God bless him. But, I mean, everybody, the girl with cancer, Buzz Aldrin, it just kept going on and on. It was the longest State of the Union address, I think, ever in history. It was an hour and 20 minutes. And the optics.
President Obama seemed longer.
It did. But I did stay awake for the whole thing. So that's an accomplishment for President Trump. But the women in white, you're right. I kept saying, who are the Klan members? Who invited the Klan? That's sitting over there.
Well, they were supposed to be channeling suffragettes, but when President Trump took up the issue of, say, banning late-term abortions, and those would-be suffragettes sat on their hands,
sure
somebody might want to tell them about Susan B. Anthony's position and the other suffragettes' position on the sanctity of human life, where they would have been had they been sitting in the chamber today and the topic been late-term abortion.
Well, and this is the lighthearted moment when there's a little give and take between the suffragettes and President Trump.
Together, we can break decades of political stalemate. We can bridge old divisions, heal old wounds.
Sorry, this is it.
No one has benefited more from a thriving economy than women, who have filled 58% of the newly created jobs last year.
Well, look around. Should we stand? Do we stand? Are we going to stand? Let me know when you get bored. 3, 2.
Yeah. That was great. It was a great moment for them to congratulate themselves on being elected to Congress, which is what they were doing.
Right.
And there's nothing more joyous than joining in with self-congratulatory politicians.
And what was Nancy Pelosi doing? Was she ordering off the gluten-free menu? Because she kept having, looked like she had a menu in front of her. Did you see that? I mean, she was looking at his speech, obviously, a copy of his speech, but it was very.
She had some difficulty sounding out the bigger words. Here's the top line, which was sort of delivered at the end to wrap up the speech. He starts with the boys who stormed the beaches at Normandy, which is a good way to start. and he ends with a call for choosing greatness.
This is the time to rekindle the bonds of love and loyalty and memory that link us together as citizens, as neighbors, as patriots. This is our future, our fate, and our choice to make. I am asking you to choose greatness. No matter the trials we face, no matter the challenges to come, we must go forward together. We must keep America first in our hearts. We must keep freedom alive in our souls. And we must always keep faith in America's destiny.
And then everybody in the chamber clapped and immediately resumed to choosing pettiness. And then things just march on as they normally do inside the Beltway. But a nice sort of transcendental call, which you sort of anticipate in States of the Union speeches. And that's what Trump gave. For me, and yes, we'll take your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. There were two moments that competed for my personal best moment,
okay,
my favorite moment.
What are they?
One was calling out the ghouls by name, Northam and Cuomo and all of those would-be suffragettes who support murdering children. I think that's a good position
no, that
to
was
take.
A poignant moment, definitely.
And number two, or in terms of the competing, was his message to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Maduro caucus that was present.
We stand with the Venezuelan people in their noble quest for freedom, and we condemn the brutality of the Maduro regime, whose socialist policies have turned that nation from being the wealthiest in South America into a state of abject poverty and despair. Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free.
USA, USA,
born
USA.
Free as the wind blows, as free as the grass grows.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking about the State of the Union address. Just in terms of doing a quick top line, what did you think of Stacey Abrams' State of the Union response?
She seemed a little angry. It wasn't who was the group of people behind her, by the way?
Those were extras. I was waiting for them to be introduced.
Hollywood extras. Because normally you just do the response, in your office or somewhere. But she had people. She had extras.
I assume because just of the sheer number of people, they were going to carry her off stage.
I thought they were going to get up and do the way.
But then I realized there weren't enough people to do that.
Yeah. No, she was more, I think it was more negative rhetoric than what President Trump delivered in the State of the Union.
Do you, did she remind you of anybody?
She reminded me of a young Oprah.
Mm-hmm. Why? Did she remind you of...
Am I going to get in trouble now?
No, I'm just asking a question. Anyone, I don't know, maybe someone who scored a touchdown in Super Bowl 20.
Oh. Are you talking about Refrigerator Perry?
You're saying that. I'm not.
Well, I remember
I'm
he scored,
I'm
and they should
question.
Have given that ball to Walter Payton. But
I was just asking a question.
Dan.
I think it was when she said, I may be slow, but I'm no dumb cookie, that I thought reminded me of the fridge. Steve,
so bad.
9094, you're on Chicago's
oh
Morning
gosh.
Answer.
Yes, good morning, Dan and Amy. I came away State of the Union. President delivered fairly well. Just my take at it is how the left seems very angry, and before they're saying the president's unhinged in this, but he's looking sane, rational, comes across across really well to the moderates, and he could deliver that. I think you got a good basis for the argument. And, you know, that's he's good at it. So if he keeps playing the game that way and delivering, you know, it looks good for the rest of the country on, hopefully. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. We'll get to in more depth on the immigration piece, which was central, really.
Yeah.
That was the real point of the speech, talking about the accomplishments, the moments, and the heroes of America's recent past, yes. But it was really policy-wise about immigration and the impasse on the issue. I thought the one the criticism I have is I thought he should have explicitly restated the compromise he proposed a couple of weekends ago.
Yeah, I know. He didn't bring it up about Dreamers and a pathway to citizenship for 800,000 people. That was left out. I was so upset.
He didn't do that explicitly. He certainly indicated sort of insinuated, I guess is a better way to say it. He insinuated that the compromise he would propose a couple of weeks ago is still his position. But I think it would have been better just to drill it down the same way he did in the speech from the Oval Office a couple of weeks ago. And I thought that was a missed opportunity to be explicit and to even more pointedly put Democrats in the corner for being obstinate and obstructionist as they are on the issue, even as he reminded people that what I'm proposing on the border wall piece of it, the security piece of it, Democrats in this chamber voted for it before. They're not voting for now. And also, I've gone the extra step to meet them in the middle and give them other things they've asked for and they couldn't get even under President Obama. I thought that could have been a much more powerful moment if he would have been more specific.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Please go away. Let me sleep for the love of God.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Just dissecting Trump's State of the Union address, the response from the punditocracy as well. You ready for this from Van Jones?
Oh, boy.
It's tough to pick, you know, the best left response from the punditocracy or the rank and file members of Congress. But I think Obama sucktoy Van Jones gets the prize for last night. Listen to this panel discussion, Van Jones offering his take on what the president had to say.
I saw this as a psychotically incoherent speech with cookies and dog poop. He tries to put together in the same speech these warm, kind things about humanitarianism and caring about children. At the same time, he is demonizing people who are immigrants in a way that was appalling.
Demonizing child trafficking.
Hold on a second. There were people in that gallery who were children who had been torn away from their mothers at the border. He did not mention them. There were soldiers who were transgender who have been thrown out of the military. He didn't mention them. There are veterans. He talked about veterans. There are veterans who he has thrown out of this country who are dreamers. He did not mention them. And he didn't say one positive thing.
Cookies and dog poop. That's Van Jones.
Wow.
That's why Van Jones gets a show on CNN. That kind of insightful analysis. Yeah.
That's ridiculous because it was anything but that.
One of the issues Van Jones didn't want to tackle, and Democrats don't want to tackle, and you could feel their unease when President Trump started naming names, and good on him for doing so, was the discussion of what has happened in New York and Virginia over the last couple of weeks, 10 days. President Trump calling for a federal ban on late-term abortions.
There could be no greater contrast to the beautiful image of a mother holding her infant child than the chilling displays our nation saw in recent days. Lawmakers in New York cheered with delight upon the passage of legislation that would allow a baby to be ripped from the mother's womb moments from birth. These are living, feeling, beautiful babies who will never get the chance to share their love and their dreams with the world. And then we had the case of the governor of Virginia, where he stated he would execute a baby after birth to defend the dignity of every person
I am asking Congress to pass legislation to prohibit the late-term abortion of children who can feel pain in the mother's womb. Let us work together to build a culture that cherishes innocent life.
It's really interesting for him to make the choice to be that explicit. And I think it works on two levels. One, it reminds Americans or informs many Americans who may not know how extreme the Democrat Socialist Party has become on these issues. Because let me tell you something. There's differences of opinion on whether abortion should be legal or not,
right,
the specific restrictions. But very few people are on board for make a child born alive comfortable while mom and doctor decide if that child gets to live.
It's barbaric. And he did a great job of reminding the American people. Because a lot of people, Dan, when they hear abortion on the radio or other places, they don't want to hear about it. I've had, you know, we've had program directors say, whatever you do, don't talk about abortion. It's
well, those program directors are wrong.
Right. Well, I'm just saying they always say that. They did television news, too. We don't want to hear about abortion.
It's interesting. You know why they don't want to hear about them? Because most of those people are left. And the left has no problem talking about it. The left has no problem organizing marches around it, putting on pee hats in support of it on demand, ramming through legislation that makes everybody finance it on demand. And the great failure of Republican politicians in states with big urban populations, like, say, California and Illinois and New York, has been to say, because some people don't want to talk about it because it makes them uneasy, or because it's divisive, like so many, a lot of other issues are divisive too, 50-50 right. issues. Huh. We should see the entire landscape to them. And what Trump is pointing out, whether he knows it or not, is, remember, he's running for re-election in 20 in the entire country, including swing states that have sizable urban populations, including swing states that may not, on balance, be pro-life. But he's saying it anyway because it is so out of step with where the supermajority of Americans are, the Democrat Socialist infanticide position, pro-infanticide position. He sees the opportunity to properly define them, to accurately define them as the rabid cultural Marxists they are, as the extremists they are, ghouls they are. And one other thing, it should send a message to the cowards who have surrendered or thrown in with the other side in places like Illinois, that you should be talking about this issue.
Well, even, I mean, the suffragettes looked uncomfortable when he was talking about that. And even Christine Roman on CNN this morning, and she said, you know what? That resounded. What he said resounded with a lot of people, even moderate Democrats.
Yes.
Who are pro-life. She said, because what's going on here in New York and what's going on in Virginia, you know, we really need to re-examine what this law is because it is barbaric.
Even pro-choice Republicans or reasonable pro-choice Democrats, to the extent that they still actually exist. But this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity. I mean, for example, in this state, every single Republican member of the General Assembly voted against HB 40, passed by Democrats, signed by Ghoul Rahner. Every single House and Senate Republican voted against him. But you don't want to talk about it? Well, why don't you want to talk about it? Why did you take that position? Because you think you needed to? It was important to? Maybe it's part personal conviction, part political expediency. Whatever the combination is, it doesn't matter. You're indicating that you understand that is an extremist position that is not supported except by an insular super minority of pro-abort extremists.
The women in the audience, they knew it was wrong. That's why they were squirming. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
That's what I felt from thousands of miles away.
Well, and I repeat, and they're donning the cloak of suffragettes.
Oh, so embarrassing.
The Susan B. Anthony list is a pro-life organization because the actual Susan B. Anthony would have been a pro-lifer today.
Right.
And as would most of the suffragettes of the early 20th century. And they know that. It's a fraud because they're a fraud. And Trump at least has the stones to call people out and do so by name. That's a real communication political lesson and a political choice that should be internalized by Republicans, particularly in blue states.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy J talking about President Trump's State of the Union, the Dem response, taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Mike on the north side.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for playing the clips of President Trump. Is it any wonder why we love this guy? God bless America. I don't talk about who's the real Republican and who isn't. I don't remember either of the Bushes ever speaking up for unborn or now born children who the left wants to kill. You know, this whole morning, people are waking up, Christians in the good parts of the country, and they're singing God Bless America. And what are the Democrats, especially in Chicago, singing? I don't know. What are they singing, Dan? Baby, you can drive my car. I fought the law and the law won. Or don't worry, give me a happy ending. These people are sick.
But
we
got
to eliminate
Danny Solis,
them, not the babies.
Yes.
Danny Solis and Alderman Marino.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Mike. Appreciate it. Other aspirants to the presidency making news yesterday as well. Elizabeth Warren, identifying as a Native American in a 1986 Texas bar license.
Yeah, she wrote down that she was Native American Indian.
Right.
So she's been faking this for decades now.
And she's on her apology tour, right, trying to get this behind her.
And she's making it worse.
Just... Well, when you lie about something for so long and then you change your story when you decide to run for office, you know, that's going to come back to bite you. And that's what's happening to Warren. Cory Booker is in the race this week, you know.
The hero?
Oh, yeah.
He was my hero. He ran in. He'd run into houses that were on fire and save people.
Cory Booker, as well as
he's a superhero.
His best friend T-Bone, his imaginary friend. They're both in the race. Cory, yesterday, story we talked about earlier in this week with Georgetown Law Professor Randy Barnett, the confirmation of Naomi Rao to replace Brett Kavanaugh on the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Oh, that's right.
And here we go again. It's DiFi and Amy Coney Barrett all over again. Cory Booker going after Naomi Rao's faith, wanting her to pass a religious test, which is technically violative of the Constitution. Listen to this exchange on the issue of marriage redefinition.
I think that...
And of course, Lawrence is a precedent in the Supreme Court, which I would faithfully follow if I were...
Are gay relationships, in your opinion, immoral?
Senator, I'm not sure, you know, the relevance of that to, you know, I mean...
I think relevant your opinion. If you think African-American relationships are immoral, do you think gay relationships are immoral? Do you personally believe that gay relationships...
No, thing, I do not.
You do not believe that?
No.
Do you believe they're a sin?
Senator, you know, my personal views on any of these subjects are things I would put to one side, and I would faithfully follow...
So you're not willing to say here that whether you believe it is sinful for a man, two men to be married? You're not willing to comment on that?
Yes, Senator...
Excuse me?
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear your response.
My response is that these personal views are ones that I would put to one side. Whatever my personal views are on this subject, I would faithfully follow the precedents of the Supreme Court.
Well, that's what you're supposed to do.
Why do you want us to come out and say something, Cory Booker?
Have you ever had an LGBTQ law clerk?
I've not been a judge, so I don't have any law clerks.
I'm sorry, for you.
Idiot.
I'm to be honest, I don't know the sexual orientation of my staff. I take people as they come, you know, irrespective of their race, ethnicity, sexual orientation. I treat people as individuals.
So two things that are problematic. One,
he doesn't understand.
He doesn't understand that she's not a judge, so she doesn't have clerks yet.
Hello.
Number two, how many of your staff or do you have any staff that's LGBT? Well, if I ask that question, wouldn't that be violative of their rights, according to you, Cory Booker? You dope. He is. I mean, he really is unseemly. I think he is, you know, Spartacus, as it were, is the most oleaginous of all of the Democrat candidates. He is the most disingenuous. He is the biggest huckster. He's just disgraceful at every single turn, including when he's on a morning drive show. I think this is in Jersey, talking to Charlamagne and Charlamagne's sidekick about his personal life.
Oh, wait. Is he going to come out? Is it time?
Cory Booker's got a boo.
I think that if Donald Trump gets elected president at this point with the personal life that he has, you know, then anybody can.
You would only be like, you'd be like the third president, I think.
First of all, there's two more years until I might switch.
So he might get married.
Give me some time.
Well, I'm speaking into existence.
So my girlfriend might listen to this. So
you don't want to. Oh, okay. I'm about to say you don't want to marry somebody now because you start getting hot, you might become president. She might just want you for that.
No,
to be first lady.
Before I declare president, I'm dating somebody that's really special.
Oh, yeah. So Cory Booker got a boo.
I got a boo.
You must.
Cory Booker got a boo. I got a boo. Things guys don't say. But okay. You know what the rumor is? The rumor is that he's dating Rosario Dawson.
What? No, he's not.
That's the rumor online. No. What am I?
Are there
go
images
by rumors
of them together?
I don't know.
Who wore it better?
Yeah.
I mean, really? Now he's got a. Is this a beard?
Maybe that's what he meant to say. I don't have a boo, I got a beard.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know President Trump covered a lot of topics in 80 minutes last night. Some of the highlights, what he says are the accomplishments of his first 2 years in office, most notably job performance.
Yeah, 5.3 million new jobs.
In addition to some of the progress that he's made and resetting the world order, as it were, with NATO countries ponying up more money, more of their share of the common defense for the West. Talked a little bit about the upcoming sit down with Kim Jong-un to continue talks about North Korean denuclearization. That'll be the end of this month. But the real theme or the real central substantive matter to be addressed was immigration. And he addressed it straight away, as we talked about in the show, did not use the occasion of the State of the Union address to invoke emergency powers, which was proper restraint on his part, in my opinion. But he did have a lot to say on the topic, as is appropriate, because, you know, we're on a 10-day clock, and he knows it. So he's trying to make the best case he can to put pressure on Democrats to deal, and here's how he started with a positive review of legal immigrants and legal immigration.
Legal immigrants enrich our nation and strengthen our society in countless ways. I want people to come into our country in the largest numbers ever, but they have to come in legally.
Pretty reasonable position.
Yeah, and he talked about the need for the walls and made, you know, a poignant remark.
Tonight I am asking you to defend our very dangerous southern border out of love and devotion to our fellow citizens and to our country. No issue better illustrates the divide between America's working class and America's political class than illegal immigration. Wealthy politicians and donors push for open borders while living their lives behind walls and gates and guards.
That's what I wanted him to turn around and look at Nancy Pelosi and say, Nancy.
Well, I got to say, what about that? What about that dichotomy that he presents? The working class divide, the divide between the working class and the elite class, whether it's in politics or, you know, Fortune 1000 companies or the arts or academia. the division between the working class and the elite class when it comes to persons in this country illegally, persons coming to this country illegally, including the caravans that continue to move toward the border, something that wasn't happening, certainly at the frequency and size that is happening now because of the open borders, abolish ICE posture the Democrat socialists have taken. By the way, another great line that he had was, "I will never abolish our ICE heroes," talking
yes,
about ICE agents.
That was
really
great.
Good. But here's the thing. I want to just develop this a little bit because this is central, and it's central to understanding why you can't get done what a supermajority of Americans would otherwise support. Some path to citizenship for the Dreamers, people brought here into this country illegally by their parents. Some even temporary worker program.
Yeah, work visas.
There's open-mindedness to that. And a secure southern border. Why can't you get that done? That's where majority of Americans are. He's pointing out why. Because of the disproportionate political power that elites have. And here's the thing about the elites. Both parties, and it was important that he mentioned sort of the Republican donor class.
Yep.
In addition to the Democrat socialist open border types. Both of those prongs of elites treat other people the same way. Center-right, soft Republicans see these people as one-dimensional, just as the Democrat socialists do. The Democrat socialists see them as a vote, and the soft Republican, Vichy Republican donor class sees them as a one-dimensional economic man or woman, just a worker bee. And look, they're both exploitive in a sense, and I'm not saying this in a sense, look, employer-employee agree upon a wage. I'm not talking about wage shedding or any of that stuff that the left talks about. I'm talking about all they care about is using people as the means to their ends. For one group, it's votes. For another group, it's bottom line. Profit margin.
Why didn't Trump point out last night, and we mentioned this earlier, you did, talking about the compromise that he made about, you know, well, pathway to citizenship for 800,000 Dreamers.
Well, extension of the designation
right, for
3 years.
Right. And that's, I mean, you'd think that the Democrats would be all over that. And he didn't bring that up.
Well, I thought he should have laid that out, all of the component parts again, because it just gives lie to the Democrat position that the straw man argument Democrats are making, that this is just like all about the wall. The wall is a panacea. No, it's not. More border agents, more judicial teams to expedite asylum cases, technology to interdict drugs and human traffickers, as well as improving the physical barriers in parts of the border where they're needed. And point of fact, there's a story out yesterday about in the Associated Press, U.S. prepares to start building portion of Texas border wall. So as the president has mentioned before, there's upgrades going on a real-time basis.
Yeah.
And these are all things that most of the Democrats in that chamber have, who've been there long enough, have previously supported.
He's got them
dead to rights. He should have just been explicit drilling it down. But that whole dichotomy, and we'll talk to Selena Zito about this because she's really got her pulse on this, that whole thing about understanding that there is nothing compassionate, and he made that point, there's nothing compassionate about the position that the Vichy Republican donor class is taking or the Democrat socialists are taking. They are looking to other human beings as the means to their expedient ends, whether it's profit margin or political margin. And that needs to be understood. And it helps to explain why 75% of Americans can support the broad outlines of what Trump proposed, and you can't get anywhere. It's really important. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And then you got the groans, right, when the caravans were mentioned, the Democrat groan caucus.
As we speak, large, organized caravans are on the march to the United States. We have just heard that Mexican cities, in order to remove
the illegal immigrants from their communities are getting trucks and buses to bring them up to our country in areas where there is little border protection. I have ordered another 3,750 troops to our southern border to prepare for this tremendous onslaught. This is a moral issue.
I didn't get a hormone from that guy.
The lawless state of our southern border is a threat to the safety, security, and financial well-being of all America. We have a moral duty to create an immigration system that protects the lives and jobs of our citizens. This includes our obligation to the millions of immigrants living here today who followed the rules and respected our laws.
That's a great point. Here's something else he could have added, and I wish Republicans would promote more. I'll tell you what, I'll do you one better, because I'm pro-immigration, pro-legal immigration. As the president said at the outset, legal immigrants add much to our country. They have throughout the history of our country. That's what makes America unique, the melting pot aspect of it. So you want to waive off welfare state benefits, at least until you earn your citizenship here?
Okay.
Then we'll provide another expedited path to citizenship. And I've got more judges to process asylum claims. I want to shorten the time it takes to become a citizen. And those who want to waive off welfare state benefits, go to the front of the line. And we can do that right after we do this deal. Let's have legal immigration. Let's have people, talented people, the world over, who want to come to this country to add value for themselves and by extension for the country. Let's get them in here. I'm totally for that. But it's got to be under a regime that makes sense. And this is a regime that makes sense.
And going back to Trump's wall, I mean, he did make a good point, I thought, of talking about San Diego and how San Diego was before they built a wall. Crime-ridden. El Paso, Texas, crime-ridden before they built a fortified wall. Because El Paso is one of the safest communities in the country.
No thanks to Beto O'Rourke, who hasn't decided whether he supports the wall or not.
He only grew up with the issue, staring him in the face every day of his life.
And we've talked about the San Diego piece before, that just the data bears it out. I mean, before the wall that was constructed in 86 to present, you've seen a drop in illegal border crossings by a factor of 8. That's massive. And then you have the personnel to deal with a problem of that size. It's all, frankly, pretty sensible if there weren't people trying to exploit.
It's all political.
Right. Exploit vulnerable populations to their ends. That you've got to get that. You've got to share that. You've got to see that for what it is. And it's, you know, it's the far left and the Vichy Republicans on the right, the Jim Edgars, to put it in Illinois context, the Jim Edgars and the John Rose, who are part of this, you know, business immigrant coalition bull jive. They don't care about those people. They see them as one-dimensional, the same way the left does. I say it again. The left wants them for political margin, and the center-right corporate C-suite type wants them for profit margin, and they're both despicable. Jim in Tampa here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Really, so glad to hear you talking about this, because there was a time we as voters could pull a lever for a letter R or D, and that was our job, was to pick the right letter. We have to be educated, and we have to understand what's happening here. The R and the D doesn't mean anything. We have to recruit better. We have to have people in the local grassroots level that are not corrupted by this. And then we have to recruit people. I mean, people like Mike and the LGBT party to go up there and say, no, I'm not playing this game. This is what we're going to do. We're going to do the right thing, whatever the right thing is. Trust is gone. I mean, we just have to rebuild trust by recruiting good people at the grassroots level. We can't just pick an R or a D. It doesn't work.
Thanks.
But I'm so glad to hear you talking about this. It's great stuff.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate it. Now, Stacey Abrams.
Okay, yes.
She responded to the immigration discussion. This is what she had to say.
We know bipartisanship could craft a 21st century immigration plan. But this administration chooses to cage children and tear families apart. compassionate treatment at the border is not the same as open borders. President Reagan understood this. President Obama understood this. Americans understand this. And Democrats stand ready to effectively secure our ports and borders. But we must all embrace that from agriculture to healthcare to entrepreneurship, America is made stronger by the presence of immigrants, not walls.
Yeah, I mean, which is basically this parroting the same line of, you know, virtually anybody who wants to come here without scrutiny can come.
And basically she blamed President Trump for the government shutdown, calling it a stunt and all that. But we did learn a little bit about her upbringing, Dan, because it's all, you know, it's not about me, it's about me when politicians speak.
We only had one car. So sometimes my dad had to hitchhike and walk long stretches during the 30-mile trip home from the shipyards. One rainy night, my mom got worried. We piled in the car and went out looking for him. And we eventually found my dad making his way along the road, soaked and shivering in his shirt sleeves. When he got in the car, my mom asked if he'd left his coat at work. He explained that he'd given it to a homeless man he'd met on the highway. When we asked why he'd given away his only jacket, my dad turned to us and said, "I knew when I left that man, he'd still be alone. But I could give him my coat because I knew you were coming for me."
What a harrowing tale. I think that was an M. Night Shyamalan movie, if I'm not mistaken. Now, we also had Stacey Abrams provide a little bit of a levity, which was fun. I mean, I found this a little derivative, but she made it work. Did you catch this part?
You're looking at the frizz. I'm the rookie. I may be lost, but I'm no dumb cookie.
I mean, I thought that was... It was sort of a hat tip to the Midwest.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, you were mentioning you thought there were too many guests, but there were many guests that were not recognized by the president. I mean, he could have recognized Kamala Harris as special guest Willie Brown or Nathan Phillips brought by Elizabeth Warren. He did not mention those.
Elizabeth Warren brought Nathan Phillips?
No, I'm making that up.
That up. Okay.
Dick Blumenthal brought Jane Fonda. Didn't recognize Jane Fonda. Could have.
I'm so gullible.
Spent time with her. But a great moment, you have to admit.
Which one? Because I have my agreement with the two of yours. What's yours?
Well, the happy birthday.
Oh, yeah.
The happy birthday.
The Holocaust survivor and the synagogue survivor.
I mean, can you imagine?
Oh, my gosh. He turned 81.
Surviving the Dachau death camp and then surviving that horrific shooting at the Tree of Life. And also recognizing the police officer who took a bunch of bullets, thankfully survived. You mentioned how many surgeries he's still going through to fully recover, but ran to the fire to save the congregants of the Tree of Life Synagogue. Judah Samet, though, it was great. It was great the way he took it, too. This is fun.
But not only did Judah narrowly escape death last fall, more than seven decades ago, he narrowly survived the Nazi concentration camps. Today is Judah's 81st birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Hey, dear Judah. Happy birthday to you.
I think that's a first, right? For somebody to sing happy birthday.
And then the thank you with the kind of thumbs up. That was fun. That
and
was
the
a
World
fun
War
moment.
II vet who stood up and he was so excited. He was shaking his hand like, "Thank you, Trump. We love you." That was cool, too.
Yeah, there was a lot of, there were some very cool moments with some of the people that the president did invite to attend the speech and help tell their stories. Important.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Almost as painful as listening to Ralph Northam talk about his impersonation of Michael Jackson for a dance contest 35 years ago, is listening to Liam Neeson off script telling a story from 40 years ago about seeking vengeance for a friend, it turns out, a family friend, who was brutally raped and has since passed on. Liam Neeson, following up on the story he told to one reporter on this press junket for his new movie with Robin Roberts on the Today Show yesterday. And here's...
You want to start with the backstory?
Yeah, Neeson setting the table.
Nearly 40 years ago, where a very dear friend of mine was brutally raped. And I was out of the country, and when I came back, she told me about this. And she handled the situation herself and her rapist incredibly bravely, I have to say that. But I had never felt this feeling before, which was a primal urge to lash out. I asked her, did you know the person? It was a man. No. His race? She said he was a black man. I thought, okay. And after that, there were some nights I went out deliberately into black areas in this city looking to be set upon so that I could unleash physical violence.
So he walked around, yeah, with this stick, like a bat. They call it a gauche. And he did it a bunch of times, and now he feels bad about it.
And I did it for, I'd say, maybe 4 or 5 times. Until I caught myself on. And it really shocked me, this primal urge I had. It shocked me, and it hurt me. I did seek help. I went to a priest. I heard my confession. I was reared a Catholic. I had 2 very, very good friends that I talked to. And believe it or not, power walking.
Power walking.
Yeah, 2 hours every day.
That's how I get all the rage out of me, is just power walk to and from the studio.
2 to 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. That's how he calmed his nerves. But
well, remember, so at the time, he's in his mid-20s.
Yeah, this happened 40 years ago, guys. Sweet. But and then you have to, you know, come on, because the left could ruin his career. Like, they have other famed people. No, they could. Yeah. So that's why I think he had to come forward to tell people, I am not a racist.
I'm not racist. This was nearly 40 years ago, but... Because I was brought up in, maybe I'm rabbiting on, Rob, so forgive me. I was brought up in the north of Ireland and brought up in the Troubles, the 60s, 70s, and early 80s.
And can you explain to people what that is?
The Troubles,
can you explain to people like Robin?
There was a war going on in the north of Ireland.
Yeah, with the Catholics and the Protestants. And he went on and said if a Catholic pub was bombed, then the next day a Protestant pub would be bombed.
Yeah, familiar with the story. If you're not familiar then you have to get up to speed. We don't have time for you. You should watch the Today Show and not listen to this show. Neeson, and so then this becomes a race thing, right? And Robin Roberts, as you heard, asked the question, would it be the same if it was white? And you heard Liam Neeson say, yeah, it doesn't matter if it was Lithuanian or Irish or whatever. So then Robin Roberts says, what's the teachable moment here? What's the takeaway? Why should we care? Here's Liam Neeson's version of what the teachable moment is before we hear from Robin Roberts.
To open up, to talk about these things, you know. We all pretend we're all kind of, you know, politically correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this country, it's the same in my own country too. You sometimes just scratch the surface and you discover this racism and bigotry, and it's there. I remember when we were shooting Schindler's List in Poland 26 years ago almost, and hearing remarks from drivers who were taking us to the set, thinking to myself, am I hearing this right? This guy is making anti-Jewish comments to me.
I don't understand. So the takeaway is racism exists. I think the takeaway from Liam Neeson's story is you focus on the responsible party. You don't pick out a random person who fits a general description to beat up.
Right. Well, she said,
is this complicated?
She made the point that, you know, an innocent black man could have been killed because of your anger.
I know.
And this whole thing started because, again, the reporter asked him, how do you tap into your revenge rage during your movies? And he just explained an incident that happened 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And now we have
I mean, here's Robin Roberts. Here's what the teachable moment is, according to Robin Roberts.
But also having to acknowledge that the hurt, even though it happened decades ago, that the hurt of an innocent black man knowing that he could have been killed for something he did not do because of the color of his skin.
Or people, and they could have killed me too.
Yeah, the hurt. So every innocent black man who had nothing to do with this rape in question is feeling hurt because Liam Neeson was looking for them 40 years ago. This is so stupid, so dumb. It's a very simple story. You had a hot-headed Irish 25-year-old who was understandably upset by a friend being violently attacked, and so he was looking to exact vengeance on anybody who fit the description. That's dumb. That's hot-headed.
But now he has to apologize to all African-Americans or African-American Irish.
But to get beyond it being a difficult conversation and understanding that we do need to get to the root of it, to stop just talking about it and not... I know that you're getting crucified in many ways before saying what you did.
Sure.
And you're not shying away. You're admitting that it was wrong. You've learned from that.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, I'm sorry.
Because somebody, like, I'd rather watch somebody's eyes be ripped out than listen to any more of Robin Roberts.
What about get your spleen torn out with a rusty spoon?
The takeaway is this. You enjoy vigilante justice on the silver screen. You don't engage in it in real life.
And he's walking it out, man.
What does this have to do with this? This is nothing. This is not about race. I asked, give me a description of the guy who did this, and I'm a hot-headed Irishman who's going to go out and look for that guy or look for anybody who fits that description and, you know, try and pick a fight. That's stupid. So the lesson is don't be stupid. I mean, honestly. This is so dumb. Tom in Deer Park. Everything has to be forced through this racial prism. Everything has to be forced through this racial prism. It's so tiresome. Sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. You know, my takeaway is that this is a man expressing his honesty of his human nature, of his sinful nature. No crime was committed. No one was hurt. But he's trying to pass it along to tell the rest of us, you know, that if you have these bad feelings, they're sinful. Remorse and redemption. That's the takeaway. That's Catholicism, Christianity. What's with these people?
I love him. He honors his friends. And friendship's important to him. And his friend was attacked, and he was going to take it to the streets, which he did.
Yeah.
That's good. He's a man's man.
Be specific. That's all.
Yep.
Find the responsible party, not anybody who looks like it could be the responsible party. Oh, okay. Fine. This is so complicated. We need to have a national conversation about Liam Neeson's anecdote from 40 years ago. Are we out of our fracking minds? This is grade school stuff. Really? Steve in Oak Brook.
How you doing? Great show. Just really quick. It wasn't too long ago that we were playing a knockout game where innocent white folk were getting struck on the street in Chicago by unsuspecting black folk. So
yeah, that's right.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Yeah, it happens, right. Yeah, so it's ignorant, too. A lot of here's something everybody knows, but I guess we have to restate it. You know, young men, not properly supervised, disciplined, a lot of testosterone pouring through their veins, get in fights, get in scrapes, do stupid things. It does not necessitate a national conversation on race or toxic masculinity even.
Well, I'm sure his agent put him up to this and said, look, if you want a future in Hollywood, you have got to address this right now.
Right. George in Libertyville.
So I'm Liam Neeson. If you were an innocent black man 40 years ago, just consider yourself lucky because on the screen I have special skills. You could have died. And for all those people, I'm sorry. How insane is this?
I know. Thanks, George. And Liam Neeson, he points out, and probably more likely,
I would have
could have got his ass kicked because, yeah.
He even said that, or I could have killed him, or I could have been killed, yeah. Robin.
Liam Neeson in real life may not be the Liam Neeson you see on screen, and he may pick the fight.
Really?
This is another lesson, too. You may end up picking a fight with the wrong guy, right? This is the line from Gran Torino, Clint Eastwood. Do you ever run into somebody that you shouldn't have messed with? Yeah, mm-hmm. That's me.
Yeah. Get off my lawn.
Bill in 294.
Yeah, you know, lucky they didn't have cell phones back in them times because he could have got on the yell and he would have got his wish. Or maybe he could have wore one of those coats with the furry collars that they're ripping off. But one other thing, his power walk, mm-hmm. That wasn't a power walk. It was. Yeah, I think he did run into somebody that's called running.
Thanks,
Bill. I will find you. And I will kill you.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Ever notice how you come across somebody once in a while that you shouldn't have f***ed with? That's me.
Yeah, Liam Neeson's lucky he didn't run across that guy 40 years ago. Otherwise, he may not have a movie career to worry about. Talking about Liam Neeson and his carrying on about this... rage incident he almost had 40 years ago, and now we've got to obsess about race and so on and so forth. Raz in Bolingbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show. I always learn something from it.
Thank you.
Liam Neeson has a movie coming out either later this month or in March, mm-hmm. And it's about a father whose son gets killed in a drug cartel operation or something like that, and he then goes out and takes revenge against all of the other of the cartel members. So
yeah, right, real novel plot line. Yeah, right.
Never heard it before.
Yeah, but that's what I was thinking when I heard it. I was like, is this a pre-release publicity stunt or something like that? Because it just seems, seems too timely to be a coincidence.
Well, the reporter asking him about, all these characters that he plays, that he has how he taps into his revenge and the anger, and that's when he recalled the story, and that's...
Yeah. It's because it would have been less compelling if he would have just said, I just watch every other movie made by Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Mel Gibson that has the exact same plot, and I just channel them. That's not quite as compelling.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Pew is out with a new study on religiosity. They find that people who are actively religious, practitioners of their faith, church attendees, are happier than the less religious. They looked at 19 countries. Gaps are striking. In the U.S., for instance, 36% of the actively religious describe themselves as very happy, compared with only 25% of the inactively religious and 25% of the unaffiliated. Significant difference. Also, there tends to be a good connection between better health and religious devotion, because people who tend to be practitioners of their faith, for example, smoke and drink less than their counterparts who are not religious, serious about their religion, serious about their faith, or otherwise active. In all but two of the 19 countries Pew looked at for which data available, actively religious less likely than the unaffiliated to smoke, and in all but one country less likely than the inactively religious to smoke as well, for example. There's additional societal benefits to practicing your faith. A Wall Street Journal op-ed by an executive at the Philanthropy Roundtable last week. Among Americans who attend services weekly, 45% do volunteer work compared with 27% for the entire population.
Amy Jacobson.
Amy Jacobson.
May I say?
Yeah. Well,
I do.
Yeah,
I mean,
you're a good example. It's a real thing.
It's so true.
A number of studies that find that church attendance, including in urban centers, associated with better academic performance, more success in holding jobs, less incidents of criminal activity.
Jacobs.
Yes, you have not committed a crime in some time, ever since you started attending church.
Yeah.
So the disappearance of churches, what to do with empty churches, the headline of this op-ed in the journal I was referring to, combined with the disappearance of parishioners in states like Illinois, when you have an exodus like we're seeing, an exodus not seen since the Israelites fled Egypt, Illinois leading the nation in out-migration 5 years running, and that will continue. And a local pastor named Mike Woodruff, a senior pastor at Christ Church, he's actually finally figured this out, one of the few in the clergy who has. Hey, if all our parishioners leave, all our congregants leave,
we might not.
That's not good for the church. It's not good for the community we attempt to serve. So it turns out that just because we're not getting forced out of our church through confiscatory property taxes like homeowners are or commercial businesses are in Illinois, we get impacted too. Nobody gets out of this catastrophe called Illinois unscathed. Welcome to the party, men and women of the cloth. I'm sorry to say the Catholic Church in this, certainly the Archdiocese, is not as woke, if I could borrow a word, on the topic as Pastor Woodruff, who joins us now. Mike Woodruff, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good to be here.
So, describe your sort of coming to terms with the fact that Illinois' economic death spiral has a negative impact on faith communities.
Yeah, such a happy topic for early in the morning.
Wow.
A few years ago, I was reading an article in The Economist. I was sitting at O'Hare Airport. I was reading an article in The Economist, and it was on Illinois' pension woes. And I glanced up at the screen, and I saw a news report about rioting in Greece. And I had one of those serendipitous moments where I thought, maybe I had to pay more attention to some of the challenges that are affecting the state and affecting people. As you know, I mean, real people get hurt because of these things. And so that was a few years ago.
Well, and okay. And so the conversations you've had with your colleagues in different faith communities about, have you noticed you see dwindling attendance at your services? Hey, have you noticed that people are having a more and more difficult time of making it a go here? Have you noticed that maybe some of the policies being advanced by the political ruling class in the state of both parties should be addressed by men and women of the cloth?
Yeah, so I started, I'm obviously in lots of those conversations, and you're always trying to figure out how people are doing and how things are going and what the trend lines are. The reason I wrote the letter that I wrote was because lots of people who end up on staff at a church are people who are sort of wired and inclined to run towards the crisis and not necessarily to try and prevent it. And so it's just a little bit of a, let's get ready for some of the additional challenges that are in the pipeline. Some of these things are in the pipeline. There's no avoiding them at this point. So let's think ahead to how we get better positioned to help people who are going to get hurt pretty significantly by some of the challenges that are in the pipeline.
Yeah. Is there, how do you suggest we try and get more people to church? I mean, I was part of two churches, St. John's,
and they closed down,
and then the one in Skokie, the Episcopal Church my grandparents started, that shut down, too, because of low attendance.
Yeah, well, you know, we've sort of seen a big shift in the last, in 50 years, in one sense. We sort of moved from a Sabbath where people were restored to a Sunday where people have been amused, to a weekend where people are trying to catch up, and now I think there's a little bit of pushback on that front. So, yeah, I mean, Andy, we'll sign you up to help promote churches throughout Chicago, and as you noted earlier, there's lots of studies that suggest that life works better when people figure out what life is about and are connected to God and others and are serving people and sort of have rightly ordered loves and all the things that for 2,000 to 3,000 years we've known about.
Yeah, well, I figured that out through scripture, not me, but I figured it out, I understand it, and I'm trying to act in furtherance of it. But let me tell you something else about Illinois in particular, and I'm Catholic, so let me just talk about the Catholic Church. With the exception of some parishes, like the one I attend, the Catholic Church has been a disgrace as it pertains to taking up any of these issues that have hurt its parishioners. And I'm not just talking about scandal within the church. I'm also talking about the scandalous policies promulgated by Illinois' political ruling class. They have been absent without leave on these issues. As tens of thousands, now we're getting into hundreds of thousands of Illinoisans flee for other states every year. Absent without leave. They've said nothing except, frankly, to throw in with the political ruling class more often than not. And so part of this is a little bit of accountability, I would hope, not just in the Catholic Church, but I'll start there, my own faith, for what they have allowed to metastasize on their watch. They're not innocent. They're not absolved of responsibility. They're here. And I would say the same thing of other faith communities. What are you doing to prevent Illinois from being the worst governed state in the country, which it is?
Yeah. So, Dan, I'm not sure what you want me to say.
Well, yeah. I want you to say. Either clergy gets involved, religious leaders get involved in the political and policy process, or they don't. And the question is, you know, what are clergy going to do?
Yeah. Well, so the clergy don't act as a monolithic block, as nobody does. But yes, the good government matters to people, and we see it, and we're seeing it now. And what I have been trying to do is a little bit less of the prophetic role, although I'm absolutely all for that. I think we need to speak truth to power, and we are trying to do that. I'm also saying let's figure out ways to educate, but also to help, and let's figure out how to mobilize people to love and serve. There's going to be more people hurt, so as you and others are trying to figure out how do we get out and fix the political problem, I'm saying it would be prudent for lots of people to figure out how to help others and to bring a sense of hope in the midst of this. So it's going to get worse, I believe that, but I also think that there's hope and there's reasons that if good people will step up, we can see some things turn.
Well, I agree with that. I guess my point is to say, look, I mean, all the volunteerism that we mentioned at the outset and that faith communities are so important in supporting is all good. That's great. But what I don't see is the sort of policy activism that is required just civically. Forget to just strip away any religious designation. Yeah. Civically to speak truth to power, to borrow a social justicism, as you did, to put in the fight, to make judgment calls and to inform parishioners and congregants who otherwise are ill-informed about what's going on and why, to take positions rather than do the Pontius Pilate routine that so many men and women of the cloth are content to do in this state because they say, well, that's not my role. My role is just to be a shepherd. I'm sorry, but it's all hands on deck at this point.
Okay. Well, I am one hand on deck. So.
Okay. Well, that's the way. But I mean, my point is to say you are. I mean, I'm not trying to berate you. Yeah. I'm mostly berating people that are in my church. but I just want other people to say that, to say we have to. It doesn't have to be from the pulpit. Okay, fine. But the lame excuses about C3 status and the lame excuses about that's not my role, that's not my purview, it just doesn't wash anymore for me. And I wish more clergy like you would take up these issues and have conversations within your circles of influence about them.
Yeah. Well, so, and I'm going to spin this just a little bit, and I'm going to say, I think that there are opportunities to have these conversations across the aisle. There's opportunities to have these conversations more broadly when people are serving, when people are helping, when people are saying,
I'm not simply going to sit back and be frustrated or say other people need to do things or government needs to do things. I think government needs to be responsible, and I would fault, obviously, Illinois for not being responsible. But what I'm also trying to say is there's opportunities now to love and serve, to mobilize volunteers, to figure out how to help people. So in the midst of when you're helping somebody, you have a much greater opportunity to try and persuade them that maybe they ought to take a look at what you're saying on other fronts.
Yeah, so, no, agreed. Exactly. Yeah, right. No, I know. That's my point. That's why it's actually men and women of the cloth that are best positioned to move the needle and to imbue people with a sense of hope to dispel the fatalism that otherwise afflicts this state. That's sort of my point.
Yeah. And I do. And I have tried to say, that's one of the other things that I've tried to say. When I first did a deep dive on this 3-4 years ago, you may know this, Dan, but it's hard to get invited to parties when you want to talk about how bad things are and how bad they're going to get. And while, you know, most states are paying 9% of their budget towards public pensions, and we're at whatever, approaching 30, and we're headed north of that. And how do you balance budgets, and how are you going to fix this? And at some point I woke up and said, okay, we've got to bring a little bit of hope and can do, and let's do this and let's tackle this. And it also comes alongside caring for people. I'm trying at Christ Church, trying to mobilize more volunteers, serve more people, work through all kinds of existing organizations to make things better. And at the same time say, you know, big government is a moral issue. We need better government.
All right. He is Pastor Mike Woodruff, senior pastor at Christ Church. You should check out the story, which is how we came to identify Pastor Woodruff. It's Gospel Coalition, thegospelcoalition.org, thegospelcoalition.org. Church's Brace for the Illinois Exodus, as well as the piece in the Wall Street Journal, What to Do with Empty Churches. Pastor Woodruff, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
Madness.
This is 60 seconds of sanity
with Dan Proft.
It's pretty good. By the way, just the topic with Pastor Woodruff. Where has our Cardinal Supich been? On this topic of what's going on in New York and Virginia. Where has the Catholic Church been to make pronouncements on this? They should be making a pronouncement like you're about to hear from me. The philosophy of infanticide. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam may soon be moonwalking out of our lives forever, but the Democrats' socialist support for infanticide isn't going anywhere. Northam's recent support for killing a baby after birth followed Andrew Cuomo lighting up the New York skyline in celebration of the same. This is who cultural Marxists are. The cultural Marxist isn't making a scientific argument when he offers the bumper sticker paeans to women's reproductive health. He's making a philosophical one. The proponent of infanticide is the utilitarian. Their philosophical leader is Princeton University bioethicist Peter Singer, who says with the standard issue, cultural Marxist Paul won't, when he argues that a baby's right to life is contingent on the happiness he enjoys and brings to others. Singer argues it's okay to kill a disabled child if that killing will lead to the birth of a non-disabled child with better prospects for a happy life and the creation of enjoyment for others. Utilitarianism is the mentality that promotes a culture of death. And good on President Trump for calling it out last night in the State of the Union.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Born free as the wind blows.
Yeah.
As free as the grass grows.
Andy Williams should have been singing back up to President Trump during the State of the Union when Trump offered this philosophical missive to the Maduro caucus present in their white suits.
We stand with the Venezuelan people in their noble quest for freedom and we condemn the brutality of the Maduro regime, whose socialist policies have turned that nation from being the wealthiest in South America into a state of abject poverty and despair. Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free.
Yeah,
and then
baby.
The lion was running because the lion was free.
Freedom! That was his William Wallace moment, no. Minus the beheading, which is the good news.
And I love when he said, we renew our vow that America will never be a socialist country.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that hit home. And Ocasio looked down at her shoes.
And by the way, all of them in white suits, the would-be suffragettes. Nancy Pelosi in the white suit. Tom Wolf looked better in his white suit yesterday, and he passed away in May of last year.
I mean, I thought I was watching a tried-out sorority conference there when they're all clapping and giving high fives, you know, when President Trump talked about women in workplaces.
All Americans can be proud that we have more women in the workforce than ever before. Don't sit yet. You're going to like this. And exactly one century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before.
Yeah, they congratulated themselves.
High-fiving each other.
The important points he made, though, about the economy's performance during his presidency. Very important. And the timing couldn't have been better because it's against the backdrop of the story this week. Andrew Cuomo getting a hard lesson in Econ 101. $2.3 billion are missing from state coffers in New York.
How did that happen?
Yeah, Andrew Cuomo's lament.
SALT was an economic civil war. It literally restructured the economy to help red states at the cost of blue states. That's exactly what it did. It was a diabolical political maneuver in the tax code that actually raised taxes on Democratic states, lowered taxes on Republican states, and financed the Republican state tax cut from the Democratic states. I mean, if people actually understood what it was that they were doing, there would have been an uprising. We are now seeing the effect of it.
Oh, there was an uprising, Governor Cuomo.
He talks funny.
People are leaving the blue states, the high-tax blue states, to the low-tax red states. You know why they're Republican and Democrat states? It's because the policies that are being chosen at the laboratory level, Cuomo. And so, yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. High tax blue states like New York and Illinois and California are hemorrhaging revenue and population. And of course, the two are connected. And that is all within your power, Governor Cuomo. It's the choices the Democrat Pauls in those blue states are making. So, boo, frackin' who, cry me a river. This is just fantastic. Who could have predicted this? $2.3 billion drop in revenues. This is serious as a heart attack, Cuomo said. It's worse than we anticipated.
Oh, my God, who took the money?
The most serious revenue shock the state has faced in many years. Yeah, because people are leaving. And he's, God forbid, the rich leave, right, says Andrew Cuomo. Anybody who passed an Econ 101 course could have predicted this, did predict this. This is as old as time, but it's a shock to the system of the status and their static understanding of human nature, of an economy. People make choices. People go where they're treated best. And money goes where it's treated best. And it ain't being treated best in New York or Illinois and California. So it increasingly is leaving. What a lesson against the backdrop of Trump talking about deregulation and tax relief, particularly with respect to corporate tax relief that spurred investment that wasn't going on, mainly due to the complications of Obamacare. And what have we seen? Not just in terms of the job creation and the capital formation. We're just through a couple of weeks of very positive corporate earnings reports.
Yep.
And so there are places that are booming. The economy overall is doing well. And then there are places that are struggling. And all you have to do is look at the politicians and the policy choices being made in those respective places to understand what the delta is. It's the policies being promulgated by the politicians in places like Chicago and New York and L.A. And really couldn't have worked out better, the timing of the State of the Union address, as it turns out. Better that it was 2 weeks delayed so that Andrew Cuomo could offer his public lament before Trump offered his State of the Union last night.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy were talking about the portion of the Trump State of the Union address where he talked about the economy's performance, comparing that to Cuomo's lament in New York about missing tax revenue because he's missing productive people who fled the state. Corollary to that story, the Wall Street Journal, out-of-state buyers flock to Miami, you know, following on Cuomo's public lament. Preliminary data show a jump in Florida home purchasers by buyers from high-tax state. Home values in lower-tax areas have been rising faster than those in places where limiting the ability to deduct high-end state local taxes eroded some of the savings from the federal tax deduction. One of the biggest winners from the shift has been Miami. The city is experiencing more activity than usual from buyers living in states like New York, New Jersey, and Illinois.
Oh.
Yeah. Imagine that. And as Steve Moore is wont to point out, you know, there's a reason people are moving from San Diego to Houston, and it ain't the weather. So welcome, you know, all of you who are adherents to the blue state model of governance, like the one perfected in Chicago, the worst governed state in the history of America. Keep it up, and you'll just keep pushing people out, the productive people. Okay. Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. When I saw Andrew Cuomo's comments a couple days ago prior to the State of the Union address, and I thought, you know, this is a guy who must be startled every morning when he sees his own face in the mirror when he's shaving, like maybe he was expecting somebody else. That he's absolutely so unaware of these kinds of concepts. Maybe next he'll attack the governors of states like Texas and Indiana and places that are economically doing quite fine. I find it interesting that even a guy like Andrew Cuomo, in this kind of a speech, comes out and attacks Trump. You know, it's part of the whole Trump derangement syndrome that everything, absolutely, if you look hard enough, absolutely everything that you don't like can eventually be blamed on Trump.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Ralph. I mean, look, Andrew Cuomo wouldn't be qualified to be a bathroom attendant in a monkey park if his last name wasn't Cuomo.
Exactly.
And like so many of the politicians in Illinois that are scions of, you know, political families, yeah. Daily. Phil in Lake County.
Hey, Dan, Amy, good morning. Andrew Cuomo, just another thought process of the whole crony capitalism of the blue states when you consider that they have to basically pay ransom just to get companies to move their jobs to their states.
Yep.
And it's even worse, like Rahm Emanuel, when basically he's just robbing jobs from other cities in the suburbs just to bring downtown, and then he claims he's increasing jobs in Chicago. It's such phony capitalism, and obviously it's a waste of taxpayer dollars.
You're right, Bill. Good point. Thanks for the call. Jim in Rochelle.
Good morning.
But the Republicans, like Christians, should be able to convince people through logic and reason not to move to a red state and then screw it up by making it a blue state because they had to leave a blue state to come to a better state. Republicans do not do a good enough job, especially conservatives, in just sitting and debating and convincing people, look, this lifestyle, this worldview, this ideology will make a better life for you than this other worldview and ideology. Christians, like I heard your story earlier this morning, Christians need to do the same thing. Look, we don't fight. We don't stand up and say this. We just basically argue back and forth and point fingers instead of saying, look, relax. What's better? Because I'm a trustee where I live out here, and I try and make sure that people understand that in my village, this is how it's best to live, and we're not going to screw that up by bringing in some kind of stupidity. And people voted me in with that logic on my lips. So, I mean, I just thought I'd call and say, Republicans need to just go at it. We're not losing. I mean, we're not losing when we get in front of people and stand our ground. Look at the YAM. Stand your ground and people will win, a vast majority of people, because conservative values are by far better than the other side.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the overarching theme of President Trump's State of the Union address was made explicit in his summation.
This is the time to rekindle the bonds of love and loyalty and memory that link us together as citizens, as neighbors, as patriots. This is our future, our fate, and our choice to make. I am asking you to choose greatness. No matter the trials we face, no matter the challenges to come, we must go forward together. We must keep America first in our hearts. We must keep freedom alive in our souls. And we must always keep faith in America's destiny.
It was an interesting mix of offerings of bipartisanship, pointing out examples where the parties did come together, like with the First Step criminal justice reform legislation.
Yep. And they had Alice Johnson there.
Right.
She was crying uncontrollably because, I mean, can you imagine? You think you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison and a miracle happens.
And that criminal justice reform couldn't have come soon enough for the Chicago Democrat City Council.
Exactly.
So that's good news for us locally there. But also pointed partisan shots, too, on the merits, as with calling out Cuomo and Northam and the pro-infanticide Democrat Socialist Party, as with calling out the Maduro caucus that you saw seated in white suits in the Democrat Party. So it was an interesting mix. I think he did a pretty good job of not only touting his accomplishments, but also really marginalizing the Democrats by pointing out just how extreme they are on matters both moral and economic. I think he did a fairly good job with his central chore, which was to reframe and win the argument on an immigration, a border security deal. Could have been more explicit.
Yeah, he could have added, you know, the deal that he made or offered Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats about a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers and extending it to 3 years.
Yeah, just
so that they don't have to live in fear anymore.
Right, just drill down.
I mean, it's so simple.
Drill down the bullet points that he presented a couple of weeks ago. That could have been important. So that's what we heard. Now, what the left heard was, I think, best summarized by Van Jones, of all people, and you'll understand that his rhetorical brilliance is why he's earned a show on CNN.
I saw this as a psychotically incoherent speech with cookies and dog poop. He tries to put together in the same speech these warm, kind things about humanitarianism and caring about children. At the same time, he is demonizing people who are immigrants.
Yeah, cookies.
Demonize people that are immigrants. What?
cookies and dog poop.
Who would ever use that rhetorically in a sentence?
The
left was mad that they didn't talk about climate change, guns, or coal.
Calls to mind Gore Vidal. There's a wonderful rhetorician, Van Jones. For more reaction, we're pleased to be joined by Jazz Shaw, who is my favorite name in punditry now.
Jazz Shaw.
Weekend editor at hotair.com. Jazz, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, folks. How you doing?
Good. So where were you between, very high marks? And by the way, CBS sort of instant exit polling, 3/4 of Americans approved of, liked what Trump had to say generally as well as specifically on immigration. But where were you between that 3/4 of the country and Van Jones's cookies and dog poop?
Well, first of all, I'm a little upset with Van Jones for stealing the name of my upcoming autobiography, Cookies
sure.
and Dog Poop.
Yes.
But full disclosure, I did not watch the State of the Union address
what?
As it happened live. I waited and watched the highlight reel this morning. I've grown disgusted with it for a number of years now. It's basically turned into, political equivalent of the Oscars. We even have a red carpet event. It's just not necessary. I wish the presidents would go back to just sending a letter to Congress, But having said that, I did watch the highlight reel and the entire response from the Democrats, which I found far more interesting. I thought the president did, what he was expected to do. He's got to go out and rah-rah for his agenda, get in a few shots at the opposition. It was nowhere near as heated, let's say, as some of his rally speeches, which I think the base likes a lot more when he really gets out there and leads with a punch to the nose kind of thing. But, he did what he had to do. And, yeah, I would give it high marks. He got the job done, and he was not backtracking on anything that he'd said personally. He's not ceding any ground, but he was drawing a clear distinction between the platforms of the two parties, and he pulled it off in a very professional fashion.
Jazz, what do you make of, he talked about North Korea because he's meeting with Kim Jong-un in a few weeks and said this.
As part of a bold new diplomacy, we continue our historic push for peace on the Korean Peninsula. Our hostages have come home. Nuclear testing has stopped. And there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months. If I had not been elected president of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
Do you think there's any truth to that?
I don't know that we would be in a major war with North Korea because I do not see any Democrat that is currently out there, and certainly not Hillary Clinton, launching a first strike. And I still don't believe that Kim is crazy enough to launch one himself against us. He likes to talk and rattle sabers, and he's certainly insane, but I don't know if he's that kind of insane. Do I believe what he said? If you get away from the we'd be in a war part, it's beyond doubt that the situation with North Korea is considerably better than it was before Donald Trump stepped into the ring. Do I have confidence that it's going to go all the way and we're going to see a fully denuclearized North Korea? I'm sorry to say, and I don't think the president has blinders on. I'm sure he's aware of this too. Kim Jong-un is a liar. He comes from a family of liars. He comes from a family of psychotic liars. They have a demonstrated history of making promises, getting some of what they want, and then turning around and backing down on them. Maybe he'll come through. Maybe he's turned over a new leaf. I'd be thrilled if that was, what was really going on. But I can't bring myself to trust the guy.
Democrats are howling about President Trump's line that you can't have legislation with investigations, sort of a Johnny Cochran moment for him there, a nice rhythmic verse. But that's something that's been done before, frankly, by presidents under significant legal scrutiny, Nixon, Clinton. What did you make of that, sort of the shot across the bow of the Mueller team?
It didn't have to be done, but I think the base wanted to hear that. I don't believe it's going to have absolutely zero impact on Nancy Pelosi and her crew, as they have been champing at the bit to start investigating anything they can investigate. and make the news cycle about that as much as possible, as opposed to their own failed policies that they're trotting out again in their new socialist lineup. They would love to have the time between now and the 2020 elections be nothing but investigations of Donald Trump and implying somehow that, you know, he's a criminal mastermind or a Russian mole or whatever the story is this week. But it was worthwhile for him to say. He's making his case again, as I said before, but there's a significant section of the audience out there whose ears are closed to that. They've already made up their minds, and nothing anybody says is going to change them.
What did you think of the president's choice to call out Cuomo and, frankly, Northam by name, pro-infanticide legislation signed into law in New York, celebrated in New York, bottled up but proposed and supported by the governor in Virginia to, make Democrats in the chamber really uncomfortable? But it's been a while since a president has spoken so forcefully to the nation on the topic of abortion, and it seemed like a great opportunity for him that he seized to highlight just how extreme the Democrats have become on the issue, you know, far left of where the majority of Americans are.
Yeah, that's well short of the best way to describe it, I think. It's not just far left. I was glad he did that. I've written about that myself recently because, as one of my colleagues at Hot Air, Ala Pundit, said a while back, whether you like to admit this or not, infanticide is no longer a fringe topic in the Democratic Party. It's becoming mainstream in large parts of the party. And let's not make any mistake. The president was right about one thing. We're not talking about abortion. This isn't an abortion debate. When you're talking about what Cuomo and Northam were talking about, where a baby is delivered from the mother, is outside of the womb, is breathing on its own, that's a child that is born. It's not an embryo. And the first three words of the 14th Amendment guaranteeing everyone rights are all persons born. If you turn around and murder that child or even allow the child to die without making any effort, you have committed murder. So,
I mean, if women in Chicago are
pointed out in that way.
And if women in Chicago are pregnant and are shot and the baby dies, it's not a first degree. It's not one count of murder. It's two counts of first degree murder for the unborn child.
Right. And it's not just Chicago. That's
fortunately,
the law in a number of places. So there's been recognition in the legal code that, you know, you're a person before you're born. But after you're born, how was that one even up for debate? And yet it's being discussed by prominent Democrats today.
That's so barbaric.
And it's appalling.
Before we let you go, Cory Booker announced he's running for president this week, adding to the field. He was pulling a Dianne Feinstein. This will be underreported because, of course, the State of the Union is the big story. Pulling a Dianne Feinstein in committee in questioning Naomi Rao, who is a nominee to replace Brett Kavanaugh on the D.C. Court of Appeals, asking her whether or not she thought gay relationships are sinful and so forth, plumbing her religious beliefs. But the real question I want to ask you is, do you believe that Cory Booker is actually dating Rosario Dawson?
I still prefer to think of him as Spartacus. did you see how he's polling in Iowa, by the way?
No.
Did you see the last polling of the Democratic potential nominees in Iowa had Joe Biden at 29%, just double digits ahead of anybody else. The only ones that came above 10 after that were, I believe, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, and maybe one other. But no, Cory Booker and the rest of the pack, they're not even above the noise level. They're not getting above 3 or 4%. They're not gaining any traction. And they're losing this badly to an old, straight, Christian white man, 77 years of age when the election rolls around, who hasn't even announced that he's running.
Yeah, but he hasn't rolled up Rosario Dawson yet. That's the only the only thing I would say. Here's my dream.
She's my boo.
My dream 2020 field, post-primary. See if you agree.
Okay.
You got President Trump.
Yeah.
You got Michael Bloomberg as the Democrat nominee. Because mm-hmm. Biden doesn't run, then he steps in and he's like the sane Democrat. And then you got Howard Schultz. So you have three billionaires running and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's head explodes.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but that would be a bonus. I'm not convinced that Biden's not going to run.
Okay.
I think he really, he's been wanting this for so long, and his statement, I'm really the most qualified person, you know, under consideration. I don't know if his family gives him the thumbs up. I don't know if he can resist. I really don't.
He is Jazz Shaw, weekendeditor@hotair.com. Jazz, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Anytime, my friends. You have a great day out there and try to stay warm.
Take care.
Yeah, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, Mary Poppins Returns movie's out.
Oh, have you seen it yet?
No. Emily Blunt. That needs to be taken out of theaters.
Why?
Saving Mr. Banks. Off the streaming services, Julie Andrews cited for a hate crime. Mary Poppins is racist. From the Everything and Everyone is Racist files.
What now?
A professor.
A professor?
At Linville College.
Where is that?
Oregon. This professor, actually, shockingly, you'll find it shocking in a second, teaches Shakespeare, which, by the way, that's no longer required at virtually any of the top 50 universities to be an English lit major, which is lunacy. But he teaches Shakespeare and British history, which is stunning that he would teach that given his view on Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins is racist. That's what Professor Daniel Pollack Pelsner says because of her blacking up, quote unquote, when her face is covered with soot as she dances with chimney sweeps.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We should have known.
The scene in which Poppins joins Dick Van Dyke's Bert and his fellow sweeps on a rooftop for the song Step in Time, a favorite moment in the 1964 Disney classic, but now, as upon further review, a racist moment. Now, he does acknowledge that her face is covered with soot because she has gone up a chimney with her, with Michael and Jane Banks. Her face gets covered with soot, but instead of wiping it off, she gamely powders her nose and cheeks and gets even blacker. Obviously, this is intended to be a subliminal racist screed. Julie Andrews as Mary Poppins. And that scene in particular. That's how crazy the left has gone. That's the end game of the race and gender identity obsessed cultural Marxist. You sure you want to throw in with them? You sure you want to put that hate has no home here sign in your yard? Because this is what you're signing up for.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Boy, not a great night for some of the left's leading lights. I know Chuck Schumer was giving Stacey Abrams high marks for her strength. I mean, she just read a speech. But happy Lunar New Year for her opener? This is a little strange for me. Also, Peggy Noonan, the measured Peggy Noonan, sort of taking out after AOC. Good-natured with the white jackets, who I see some on Twitter calling straight jackets. AOC had a rare bad night, looking not spirited, warm, and original as usual. Well, that's generous. But sullen, teenage, and at a loss, AOC responded with more of a temper tantrum. Why should I be spirited and warm for this embarrassment of a so-too? Tonight was an unsettling night for our country. The president failed to offer any plan, any vision at all for our future. We're flying without a pilot, and I'm not here to comfort anyone about that fact.
Oh my
God. Go to your room. You go to your room.
She's not ready for prime time.
Where the adults are talking.
Maybe she's going to go dance in her room.
Speaking of the commander-in-chief talking, Trump's most salient point on the central policy issue of the speech, one that is at bar, immigration, border security. This was a key point. It's not made enough. It's not discussed enough, detailed out enough. but Trump talking about the class divide on immigration policy and border security.
Tonight, I am asking you to defend our very dangerous southern border out of love and devotion to our fellow citizens and to our country. No issue better illustrates the divide between America's working class and America's political class than illegal immigration. Wealthy politicians and donors push for open borders while living their lives behind walls and gates and guards. Meanwhile, working-class Americans are left to pay the price for mass illegal immigration, reduced jobs, lower wages, overburdened schools, hospitals that are so crowded you can't get in, increased crime, and a depleted social safety net. Tolerance for illegal immigration is not compassionate. It is actually very cruel.
I wish you would have developed that even more in the speech to explain. Basically, my view of it is what he's saying is, on the one hand, you have sort of soft Republican C-suite donor class that treats illegal immigrants as one-dimensional people, means to their ends. Cheaper labor. And on the other hand, you have the abolish ICE, open borders left that treats illegal immigrants, other human beings, as means to their ends, one-dimensional votes. Cheap labor, votes. And sort of caught in between is the 75% of Americans who agree with the broad outlines of the compromise that President Trump proposed two weekends ago, that I think it would have been helpful had he reintroduced explicitly, just ticked off the bullet points, the component parts of his proposal, rather than just talking about it in the abstract. But anyway, that's where the debate goes from now until the February 15th deadline, I suppose. For more insight on this, though, we're pleased to be joined by Selena Zito, Washington Examiner reporter, New York Post columnist, CNN contributor, and her book, The Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics. Selena, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
What about what I said about Trump's class divide argument on the immigration issue, and where the majority of the country is, at least according to most of the polling I've seen, and how, to his point, I think a small group of elites hold this whole thing up because they each have their interests of using people trying to come to this country illegally for their own very expedient ends?
Well, I mean, first of all, thanks for having me on. I think it was an important nuance that the president introduced in a way that we haven't really talked about in the debate about whether or not we need border security on the ground. And I think that you know, I think it was an important point because it creates, you know, a visual, if you will, of what the problem, you know, where the divide is and who it impacts. So it positively impacts politicians, in particular on the left, because it creates new votes and it garners voters who are already here. To be excited about how compassionate they are, but it also just creates a wedge and a divide. But when you look at their lives and the things that are important to them, you realize that it impacts people that, you know, a lot of working class people, a lot of their communities, a lot of the social fabric that make up their communities. And illegal immigration, not legal, but illegal, it is just sort of one of the components that have impacted their economic economic ability.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think he shied away from talking about I mean, not in particular the government shutdown, but the offer that he made to the Democrats with, you know, with the Dreamers, a pathway to citizenship for them, and extending some work permit visas for 300,000 people. I mean, that's, to me, was a missed opportunity. What do you think?
Well, I suspect that the president believes, if he has strong opinions, that he's made this argument enough.
Okay.
And he wanted to talk about a wide variety, a wide scope of things, and not just make that the focus of the State of the Union. I understand that. His speech was certainly well received. If you look at CBS and or CNN's polling right afterwards, the president got high marks, which is, you know, interesting, because if, you know, you watch some of these panels, you would have thought nobody, like, looked at that polling, because, you know, the panels were like about how awful it was. But, I think the president set out to do what he wanted to do. He didn't want to make that the center focus. He wanted to talk about other things that that bring the country together.
And there were moments of seemingly effective jujitsu by the president where, as your colleague Byron York wrote in the Washington Examiner, at times Speaker Nancy Pelosi sitting behind the president didn't quite seem to know what to do. She was sort of, am I supposed to stand and clap for this? Is this acceptable or am I not? Should I sit down now? With the vignettes with the people in attendance and just some of the things that he highlighted where the parties have come together to move legislation like the First Step Act.
But, and that's, you know, that's the problem for the political class, period, is that they don't even pretend to not show their hands anymore. Everything is calculated. Nobody has an instinct or empathy for anything that has to do with whatever the other party is saying. And that's not how you and I or most people that are probably listening to this show behave in their daily lives. If something good happens with someone that, on the other side of the aisle, you don't shy away from patting them on the back because they did something good. You do it. And not being able to intuitively stand up and clap when something benefits the entire country because you think that is a poor political calculation says everything about what is wrong with Washington and sort of the fact that it is a company town and the politics drive it.
What was a powerful moment for you last night during the State of the Union?
Well, I'm going to be honest. I'm from Pittsburgh. I covered the Tree of Life massacre in my hometown and singing happy birthday to the Holocaust survivor and the 81-year-old gentleman who just missed the attacks, I thought was incredibly powerful. But I also thought that the way that the president speaks about life and the value of life and the value of the unborn child is consistent and important if you are if that is an important issue for you. And I think he nailed it.
Yeah, the happy birthday to Judah Samet was fun, and it was fun because of how he reacted too, with like the thank you after the chorus was over. It was that was a nice moment.
It was adorable.
Yeah, it was
like
cool.
Literally adorable.
That was cool, and also, just again sticking with Pittsburgh and the Tree of Life Synagogue, the police officer who was shot many times in trying to stop the shooter there, having him there as well was a poignant moment.
Absolutely.
I wanted to, so before the State of the Union address, we had another attempt at from BuzzFeed to break this Russian collusion case wide open. Email dump involving the Moscow Trump Tower that was never built and exchanges between Michael Cohen and Felix Sater, these individuals within the Trump organization that were trying to put together this deal. And it, you know, it was supposed to be some sort of bombshell, but as you read all of the exchanges, it basically just confirms what we already knew to be true, doesn't it? That number one, Michael Cohen initially lied, and that's what he was charged with. And then Yes, the negotiations about a possible development deal in Moscow went on through June of 2016. And so what?
Well, exactly. He's a businessman. And no, he never pretended to be anything else except a businessman who decided to run for president. And you don't stop being a businessman even while you're running for president. And, you know, I don't know. I find the American public, even people that don't like President Trump outside of Washington, not inside Washington, because that's just a whole different level of hatred. But people outside of Washington just look at these daily like, oh, my God, this is the one. This is the story that takes you down. They're really quite agitated, exasperated with this. And I think that people have made the decision, whether they support President Trump or not, that they're going to wait till the Mueller investigation is over. And they've sort of tuned out, right or wrong, to these daily gotcha stories about Russia and the president.
She is Selena Zito, Washington Examiner reporter, New York Post columnist, CNN contributor. Pick up her book. It's very good. The Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics. And I really enjoyed it. And we've had a good discussion about it before. Selena Zito, thanks so much for joining us. As always, appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Get your deplorable little face up next to the radio or your phone, iPad, computer, smart speaker, or filling in your mouth that somehow picks up this frequency. Because it's time for America's favorite tribute rip-off radio program, Animal Stories. And now, here in person is the rip-off Animal Stories news team anchor man, woman, human, or whatever pronoun they go by, Dan Proft.
Ooh.
And Amy Jacobson. Baby, I'm
yeah, Uncle Dan and little Amy. Apologies to Larry Lujack and his family in the state. This out of Orland, Maine. Investigators say a Maine man died when returning to a burning house to get his dog. He escaped the fire in his home with his family before he went back into the home to get his dog. 40-year-old Sam Crawford, hours later, was recovered by firefighters. The two other adults and two children escaped the fire that was caused by a space heater. No word on the dog.
I think the dog died too.
No.
The owner died going back to get it.
Yeah, the owner died. So that's one for animals. Here's one for humans. Colorado jogger fought off a mountain lion in the foothills of Horsetooth Mountain on Monday.
This is awesome. You know, if you live in Arizona and go jogging, you will see mountain lions. And you'll see cougars, and they're everywhere. And so what this guy did is amazing.
Yeah, a mountain lion attacked him from behind, biting and clawing his face, back, legs, and arms. And although he suffered bites and bruises, he somehow, although it's not described exactly how, somehow sort of Seagal style managed to kill the mountain lion with his bare hands.
I know. I saw they interviewed the park ranger last night. He wrapped his hands around his neck and literally got a main artery and used all his might and
put
force.
The old sleeper hold on him.
He strangled. Well, this ranger said he strangled it with his bare hands around his neck, not a chokehold or a half Nelson or anything. He got him good with both hands.
The UFC submission hold.
Insane.
Yeah.
And then there's this story.
Sure.
This is a happy ending, too. Because everybody lives. Hey. Utah County Sheriff Search and Rescue. They posted this heartwarming video of a dog who fell 40 feet. Being reunited with his owner. They were on a remote snow hike near Stewart Falls, and the dog fell down, 60-pound dog. They tried to get it out, finally were able to wrap, rope around his midsection and pull him to safety. And this is just, the dog is crying and the woman's crying.
Which is that, the dog or the woman?
He fell into a snow bridge that was created by an avalanche that happened. Wait, now our sisters are coming in.
Oh, God.
Wait, like nails on a chalkboard.
I feel sorry for the dog. Are you sure he wasn't making a break for it?
I think I'll stay down here for a while.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.